So good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today, the focus of today is Seder in Yom Seder. The point over here is not a magnificent edifice of one huge shir, which you'll come out and you'll say, wow, that was very impressive, and now I don't even know how to start explaining that to anybody else. The point of today is to come away with some very specific ideas. We're going to try to cover 6 to 7 ideas today, which hopefully you can walk away with. You can say, you can relate it to your Seder and enhance your Seder. So every year it's going to be different ideas. We're going to go through different different ways of looking at things as we go through the Seder. There are no source sheets on this one, but the slideshow is going to be available. I'm going to send it out after the Shir, and it'll be available online for the download. So anybody is welcome to use it in that way. And and the Seder app will. No, but if you want to review the source that are on the PowerPoint, will be available. And if you need any specifics, please reach out to me. I can send you the bigger sense of it. So the first thing I'd like to concentrate on is the following. We're told the following. The role of questions. The Rambam says the following. He says, "Vatzorich." This is the Rambam in Hilchos Chametz Matzah. He says, "Vatzorich la'asos shinui balayla hazeh kedei sheyiru habanim." The Rambam says that a person needs to make distinctions, make things different this night, shuffle it up a little bit in order that the children should see, v'yishalu, and they should ask, v'yomru, manishtana halala zimikol halala. So therefore they should ask, why is this night different to all other nights? Ad sheyoshiv lohem v'yomar lohem, kach v'kach ira v'kach v'kach haya. And then you say, well, this is what happened, this is what the past was, this is what occurred in those days, and you explain to them. You need to get them to ask questions. I remember that they say about Rabbi Jonathan Sacks that when he came in before the Queen to be knighted, so she asked him the question, why is this night different to all others? I don't know if that's exactly what we expected to be getting at the Seder, but the Rambam says this, and what I find so fascinating is that any time we're stumped by a question. Right, we say it's so the kids can ask. Right, it's the last. Right, it's like they ask some sort of complicated philosophical question. You're like, "Kadeshi Shalat Yinokos." It's all in order for the kids to ask. It happens to be that there are a lot of questions which we try to stimulate, which are only seem to be for the point of questioning, because the Gemara doesn't supply the answers in a lot of cases. Let's take that a little further. The case of Neshane. How do you make a difference? Machalek lohem kloyos veegazim. Right, v'okren hashulchan lifnei. You give them nuts. This is in the days before peanut allergies. They're, I think, roasted nuts, yeah. and regular nuts, and meaning it's the equivalent of candy. And they're like, well, what's going on, Dad? Usually it's not happening at the table. You take away the table from in front of them, and you switch the matzah from hand to hand. And all these kind of unusual things, and we've developed our own great systems to make this more exciting. This is the interesting part. What happens if you don't have a child? So the interchange is done between husband and wife. What happens if a person is not living with a spouse at that point in time? Shalim ze ze. They one asks one another. Manishtana halala ze. All the people in that meal ask one another. Afilo hayu kulon chachamim. Even if they're all wise, even in that case, then. Even if you're alone, you start asking to yourself. You hope nobody's looking. Nobody's taking notes. But in the end of the day, the Rambam says a very interesting thing, is that one needs to be asking oneself. So what you see here is an interesting thing. Is more important than the periods, or we would say the full stops, are the question marks. Interesting meaning to say the information is less important than the conveying of the information. And the reason that is because certainly today, in the age and era that we live, we have lots of information. If you wanted to know about any particular subject, you could find it out within 5 minutes. You really could. But you know why most people don't know about things? It's because they're not interested enough to take the time to do that. You could pull out your phone one moment and Google anything. You could find out almost anything available. The reason why we don't all the time is because most of us have got so much going on that it's not on our sphere of interest or attention for that particular moment. Says the Rambam, the most important thing about the Seder is the educational process. It's not about conveying information, it's about conveying interest. Once you have interest, anything can be conveyed. You need to stimulate interest. In fact, this is a quotation, a very famous quotation from Isidore Isaac Rabi, who was a Polish, and later American Nobel laureate physicist, and he says the following. He says, my mother made me a scientist without even knowing it. Hmm. Every other child would come home from school and be asked, what did you learn today? My mother used to ask me a different question. Izzy, she always used to say, did you ask a good question today? That made the difference. Meaning the point is, it's not the information. The point is, are you interested? Are you stimulated? Is there something worthwhile asking about? So the Seder has so many times where it says, Kadesh Yishala Tunokas, and we say, oh, what's the point of that if we don't have an answer? The point is the question in and of itself. Ad Kadei Kach, that even if one is alone, it's necessary to be able to ask. That's an introduction to the evening, the notion of questioning. Let's take it a little further. The need for contrast. The need for contrast. The Mishnah tells us that Maschinin Bignusim and Misayim B'Shevach. The Mishnah tells us that you need to start with the Gnus, the negative past, and then we need to end up in the, you know, the clouds open, the rainbow shines, the music switches on, everything is fine and dandy. But we start off with our humble beginnings. And there's a machlokes, as we know, as to whether those humble beginnings are physical, servitude, or whether it's actually spiritual. Fine, fantastic, wonderful. Just to appreciate this, educationally, you know, today in the 21st century, we've developed all these tools, and over the last 50 years, we've had an extreme focus on education. But Chazal understood, and Chazal understood education to a fine degree because our nation's built on education. And one of the tools they use is this notion of contrast. There's a famous story, which is in the book. There's a book called "To Sell Is Human" by Daniel Pink. And he has a story in the book where there was a fellow who's there walking through a park, and there was a fellow who was a blind person. I'm sure many of you know the story. And he's sitting there, and there's a sign over there, and the sign says the following. The sign says, I am blind. And he's sitting there, and people are walking by, and most people are, you know, trying to ignore him as they walk by in a hurried rate. And one of the executives he's walking with turns to the blind man and says, would you mind if I added 3 words to your sign? So the man says, well, you know, I've got nothing to lose. It's not as if business is coming in very fast. So he wrote the following 3 words. And he wrote those words, and then what happened was, is the blind man sitting there, and for the rest of the day, money keeps coming in. He has coins, he has notes, he has people taking change. That's a good sign, right? He has people taking change, and at the end of the day, he turns to somebody who's walking by and he says, would you mind just reading me what's written on the sign? Something, those 3 words must have done a huge, must have made a huge impact. And he turns around, and the man reads in the sign, and the sign says the following. The sign says, it's springtime, and I'm blind. And suddenly people started thinking, why? What's the point? The point is that when people got the sense of contrast, they're walking through the park, and it's a beautiful day, and they see the blue skies, they see the clouds going through them, they see the beautiful trees as their bright green new leaves are blooming, and the blossoms are falling. And then they see this man now, who's blind, is not able to appreciate that. That gave them the sense of empathy. That gave them the sense of wanting to be part of this. Why? Because they had the sense of contrast. Say Chazal, in the almost the opposite way. You can't just walk into the Seder and say, well, you know what? We were saved by God. In order to be able to appreciate, you need to understand exactly what we're doing. We need to taste the bitter herbs. We need to see the mortar of the charoses. We need to experience what it was, and then we can say, ah, now we understand. In order to be able to get there, you need to be able to have the contrast. The value of contrast, which is so important over here as an educational tool. We've just seen these two ideas in terms of both the notion of questions and the notion of contrast. Let's take it a little further. There's a very famous question which is asked by everybody and their brother. Why it is that Magid doesn't have a bracha? Why is it that Magid doesn't have a bracha? I'd like to just stop at this moment just to say that today's shir is sponsored as a happy birthday for David Levy, in honor of his wife, who just had his birthday this week. And we wish you many happy returns, and thank you for being a constant in our shir. And we look forward to celebrating with you many, many, many more years in good health. We'll leave the singing until afterwards. So, everybody asks the question, why is it there's no bracha on Magid? Right, this is a mitzvah. The Torah tells us, explicitly, there's no going around this. And nevertheless, we don't say a bracha. And everybody asks the question why it is. there's many very fascinating answers as why it is, why not. This first MS says something most unusual. I hadn't come across it until this year. He says the reason is because it's like a birkas ben odom lechavera. It's like the bracha, one would say, between of a mitzvah which relates to different people, between actions between different people. Have you ever noticed that you never ever say a bracha on, let's say, tzedakah? You don't say a bracha on chesed, right? These are important mitzvahs. You don't say a bracha on v'avta l'reicha kamocha. When it comes to interacting with our fellows, we don't say a bracha. We usually only say a bracha when it comes to something we enjoy, or when it comes to a birkas hamitzvah, where it relates to something which is our relationship with God. But it doesn't. We don't have it in the realm of ben olam lechavera. So it says the same. It's the same. It's the same reason. Now, why? Let's take a step backwards. Why? What's unusual about ben olam lechavera? What's special about ben olam lechavera that doesn't necessitate a bracha in the first place? Famous answer by the Rashba, the Tshuvas Rashba says. Anybody familiar? What's the reason why there's no ben olam lechavera? The Rashba says.
Not quantifiable.
Well, and it's not about quantifiable, but it's not in your control. That's the way the Rashba understands it. Let's say you say a bracha, Harani Mochel Mezuman, and you say the bracha, and you give the poor man the money, and he throws it on the ground and walks off. What are you going to do? You're not in control of the mitzvah. When there's another person, there's another factor in the equation, you don't have full control of all the variables, because it's relating to another person, says the Rashba. That's the reason why there's no bracha on a ben olam lechavera. However, says the Sfas Emes, no, it's deeper than that. It's more fundamental. The Rashba is a technicality. The Sfas Emes says the reason is simple. Let's imagine a world in which there weren't Torah. Let's imagine a world in which we weren't commanded. So let's take it back to pre-Matan Torah. Was there an obligation to be a good Samaritan? That's a very bad term. But was there an obligation to be good to people, to honor parents? And the answer is, there were certain things which were fundamentally, morally necessary. If you were to sit there and philosophize, you would come up with them. And in fact, a number of the philosophers do. They come up with slightly different utilitarianism, you know, the critique of pure reason. There are many different ways of getting there. But in the end of the day, some form of morality has to exist based on simply in a pre-Torah existence. Says the Sfas Emes, therefore there's no bracha on it. Because Hashem created the world in such a way that there are certain logical constraints. Honoring parents is. We do it now. Why? Because Hashem commanded. But that was there. That was necessary. Hashem put that in creation. That there's a natural feeling that humanity feels. They feel indebted when receiving something from somebody else. There's a natural feeling that we want to protect others. Those things we saw in Sefer Brachot, because they are logical. They are mishpatim. Says the Sfas Emes, that's what's going on at the Seder. At the Seder over here, when we're experiencing this, and as we're pointing out, it's not about going back to history. History is linear. History, you have to go back 3,000 years and say, you know, what happened then, and try to remember the details. When it comes to the Seder, we're going back to the cycle. The way that I heard this once described is that the Jewish year is like a 365, or 354 actually, 354 elevator shafts. And if you imagine in a building, you have a large building and you have all these different shafts of an elevator. So day one of creation was the first of, day one of creation for humanity was the first of Tishrei. So the next year around on the first of Tishrei, it's the same shaft, just one floor up. So that means to say that when we're on Pesach, we're essentially now 5,775 floor, on the 5,775th floor of the same elevator shaft. Meaning, there's the same aura that's existing in that day. It's not that we're going back in history. We're experiencing the same thing if we can tap into the aura, into the, we'll call it the scent, into the expression of that particular elevator that we're in at that time. If we're doing that, then we're saying, wait a second, God did so much for us. Thanking Him is not going to require bracha. It's so obvious. It's basic humanity to say thank you. It's basic humanity to appreciate what Hashem did for us on that night. Says the Sfas Emes, therefore no bracha. Takes a bit of a different perspective, because in the end of the day, you're not being a great person by saying thank you. You're being a normal person by saying thank you, says the Sfas Emes. Because it is only human to respond to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by thanking Him that evening. Unbelievable thought. Very interesting pathway in. Idea number three. Let's take it to idea number four. Karpas. And Karpas is wonderful, and why do we do it? What's the Gemara say? Kedai Shiyah Shalat Tinakas, brilliant. Right, so the children should ask. So we should end right here, right? But as it happens, that there's a little bit more to it. There's a little bit more to Karpas. And it's obvious that there's obviously symbolism, the different vegetables that go in. I know that, I think I've heard, in fact, in the name of, I think that Rabbi Tights used to use a banana, or maybe used a banana.
Pineapple.
But because he used it particularly, he used it particularly to show that there was a bracha, the bracha was a hadama. Many people have different minagim as to what to use, radishes and parsley and potatoes and all wonderful kinds of things. In the end of the day, we're dipping it into salt water. What is going on over here? So there's a fascinating Gemara in Pesach. The Gemara says like this. This is the end of the parak. The Gemara says, Tana kol echad ve'echad noisen pischa ba'oiroi u'mafshil la'acharov. So the Gemara says that every person were to take their Pesach, and they were in its skin, and they would put it on their back. They would carry their Pesach, their Korban Pesach on their back. And the Gemara would say, Amar Rav Ilish Tayos. Rav Ilish would say, like Tayos. Okay? What are Tayos exactly? Rashi says, Tayos Derech Sochrit Nishma'elim Huzeh. It's the way of Arab salesmen. That's the way they would carry their wares. They'd walk around with it on their back. Now the problem is let's review for a moment. Who were the aggressors? Who were the antagonists in the Egyptian story? They were Egyptians. Now Egyptians and Ishmaelites today, you might say the lines are blurred. In those days, they were actually different families. Ishmael is a son of Abraham, and Mitzrayim is the son of a completely different side of the family. Mitzrayim is the son of Ham. Right? He's one of the children of Ham. Completely different, a different side of the family. So. Meaning, this is the wrong story over here. It sounds like symbolically we're carrying our Pesach on our back in order to be able to commemorate the Arabs. But they weren't part of the story. We had different problems of those days. Fantastic. So what happens is that Barbara Nell says, well?
They started the whole thing with the
book. Oh, so Barbara Nell says that, you know what? Fascinatingly enough, that Barbara Nell says, of course they're part of the story. You just need to have a bit of perspective. Because in the end of the day, how was it that we actually got down to Mitzrayim?
Yosef.
Was because of Yosef. Why did Yosef get down to Mitzrayim? Because he was sold by his brothers by, initially, Sochrim Yishma'elim. Now, it was interesting. There's an interchange between who the merchants were at the end. But be it as a main, he was sold down. Now, Barman now goes so far as to say that, in fact, the whole of Golas Mitzrayim was a punishment for Mechiras Yosef. And he goes and he starts paralleling all the ideas. He says, you know, the fact that the Jewish babies were thrown into the river was as a punishment because Yosef was thrown into the pit. The fact that Yosef was sold into slavery into Egypt was the fact that they were sold into slavery in Egypt. He goes further. He says, because Yosef was started off his journey by searching for sheep, therefore, when they were searching for sheep or the sustenance, that's when they got taken down. And therefore, he says there's a number of various parallels that he brings, and that's why the shechita of the sheep is almost like at the end when the Korban Pesach is shechted is like what they did to him, that they shechted those goats when dipping his coat in blood. Says the Babanel. And he goes, so he has an extremely long description of how that all started. And if you think about it, really, you know, on a micro level, that's really where it began. So what happens? The Gemara says, you know what? When they come out of Mitzrayim, they put their Pesach on their back because we're commemorating the fact of how it all started, where it all came from. But it goes further. Rabbeinu Manoach, who's one of the earlier commentators, one of the many commentators, citizens, on the Rambam, says the following. He says that, you know why it is that we do Karpas? Coming back to us, what's this connected? He says, Karpas is to remind us about the dipping of the coat of Yosef. The coat of Yosef. What happened to the coat of Yosef? It was stripped from him and it was dipped in blood. So what meaning? He has a vegetable in salt water and he has the coat and the blood. So, you know, we're struggling to make the connection. What does Rashi say? Oh, so it could be the tears of Yaakov Avinu, but even if you want to take a little further. Rashi, in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, says, when you're talking about the coat of Yosef, it talks about as the ksones pasim. What does the word pasim mean? So one of the explanations that Rashi gives is that it is the clothes of the nobility. Why? How do you know that? Because it says, the translation for the word pasim is the word karpas.
Right.
Chur karpas or techeles. The clothes of the nobility that Mordechai wore were karpas and techeles. And therefore, says Rashi, what was Yosef wearing? He was wearing the cloak of karpas. So what are we doing essentially? We're taking, if you think about it, you're taking the symbolism of the coat of Yosef, the many-colored coat, and you're putting it into the tears to remind ourselves how we got there. Now, but if you want to take it one step further, you want to push the idea even further than where it is right now. Let's think about it from this perspective. In the end of the day, there was a contract signed and sealed already that Israel was going down to Egypt, right? We know that. Avram was told by the Bris Ben Abisarim, this is the end of the day, you're going to be going down to Mitzrayim. There's no arguing about that. So how can the Abarbanel blame the brothers of Yaakov? Right? This sounds similar to, how can we blame Paro for enslaving a nation when in the end of the day, it was pre-decreed? You have always, certainly in the Yetzias Mitzrayim, we have a problem of the philosophical balance between Hashem's plan and people's actions within that, right? The fact that people took initiative and were held responsible even though they were part of the divine plan. Very hard thing to balance. So Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardoza says a very interesting thing. That's why we put it at the beginning of the Seder, because just like we're about to describe the beginning of what's of the galus, of the servitude, we put it there, but it's actually hidden. Meaning, up till now, and certainly for me, I didn't notice that. Up till now, it was just the potato and the salt water. The point is that it's hidden, because if you were to investigate, you would say, yes, you know what, that's how it all started. Where did the Avodim Ayinu actually start from? It started 5 minutes ago in the karpas, the dipping of the coat. But it's there because it's not obvious. You have to look into history sometimes to be able to see, yes, there was a plan, and that's what would have happened anyway. But if you look carefully, then you notice that there was a coat at the beginning. If you look carefully, you notice that there was a cause. We were actually responsible for it. That's why it's at the beginning, but it's in innuendo. It's hidden. It's not clear to us, because that's exactly the way it happened. Only looking back at history do we have that perspective of being able to realize what was actually going on. Very, very fascinating. And I think the way it is couched symbolizes exactly the power of what it is actually conveying to us itself. Very, very fascinating notion within karpas. It also sort of should put a pause in our Seder and make us think, you know, so then in the end of the day, so what causes godless then? Right, so at some point in time, meaning what caused all of this is when we just couldn't get along. And not that we couldn't get along to the point that we had to throw our brother into slavery. That's something which should take a pause.
Goes back to the Ben Adam Machaber.
Right. Maybe even greater what the Sassamis was saying, that we don't say the bracha because it's Ben Adam Machaber. Perhaps that's the very underpinnings of what the Seder is once we reach that realization. Very, very fascinating. Let's take another organic substance of the Seder. Charoi says... Right, so now, the problem is like this, Dr. Huberfeld mentioned this to me, an idea to me the other year, and I want to just bring it into focus. I don't know if anybody's familiar, I'm sure everybody's by now tasted or at least seen the Charoisis flavored ice cream from Ben & Jerry's. You know, and you have to think to yourself, what kind of inhumane people are these? You know, here you have cement, you know, I'm talking about people, your people spending, you know, 23-hour days lugging blocks. And yeah, and you're going to make ice cream out of it? You know, it's like, you know, really, how insensitive can you be? But perhaps it's not insensitive, because actually if you do a little bit of, this I wasn't taught in school, but the Gemara actually discusses whether charoisis is a mitzvah or not. And the Gemara says there's two reasons for charoisis in the first place. Reason number one, my mitzvah, Rabbi Levi Omer, zecher l'tapuach, it's the memory of an apple. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't remember any apples in Egypt. Right? So what's the tapuach? Oh, Rabbi Yochanan Omer, zecher l'tit. That's the one that we taught in day school. It's to remember the plaster, to remember the cement. Omer Abaye, hilchach tzorech l'kehuye. You need to make it sharp because of the apple. It's sorry for samuche. It also needs to be of a thicker substance because of the cement. Right? Lekihue zeichel tapuach, but sorry for samuche zeichel atit. So you have to have both elements in this. By the way, this is one of the few times that Gemara actually goes into the recipe of something about what the content. And just FYI, if you Google charoisis, the first four pages will almost without exception is just about recipes. So you know, there's very you have to dig deep to find the Torah on the charoisis. So it's interesting. So we have two ideas. The one we're more familiar with is that it is in fact the cement. What's this tapuach? So the what was that? So the Rashi quotes a pasuk in Shir Hashirim, which says tachas atapuach aratzicha. that it was under the apple tree that I initiated. What's this referring to? So the Midrash in Shir HaShirim says that what went on was that, you can imagine, the families were in backbreaking labor. They were at a point where they were psychologically impoverished, to the point where the men, who are very logical about things, says, why are we having children? Why are we bringing children into this kind of world? How can we sustain such a thing? Never mind the children just being thrown into the river, but there's no strength. How can we even be parents in this kind of climate? And it took the woman who had the foresight, who had the knowledge beyond the logic. Right? Men are very stuck in logic. The woman had the ability to be able to say that we can still do this. And they enticed their husbands, they had children, and it says that because there was such a threat of the life of their children, they would go out into the fields and have their children under the apple trees. That would be the way that they would have it, so they wouldn't be unnoticed by the Egyptians. So embedded in the charos, this is not only the cement of the servitude, but perhaps the apple, or the idea of the way that we got out of it. Why? Is the notion of the woman. Now I wanted to take it one step further. Tosus adds something very interesting. Tosus says that there's an additional layer of meaning over here. And that is that it is referring, it is also, it should also have, as Tosus adds, an active ingredient, and that is wine. Why wine? Says Tosus, quoting Yerushalmi on this over here. The Yerushalmi says that the wine is zecher le. What's the wine a memory for? Blood. Blood, says Yerushalmi. So you need to add into your charos says wine, which is about blood. Now that seems to tilt the scales, right? Because we have the cement, and then we have the apple, right? Which seem to be these two ideas in tension. And now the wine seems to sink the ship, but that's actually not clear over here, because what blood are we talking about?
The wine could be the birth blood.
Okay, so there's different bloods in Mitzrayim, but explicitly there was the blood of Milah, there was the blood of the Korban Pesach, but there was also earlier bloods. What other bloods do we have? We have the blood of the firstborn, but earlier than that even. We have the first Makkah was blood. The first Makkah was blood against the Egyptians. And there was another blood as well, if you got a little earlier, in the servitude, which was the children's blood. Right? Remember, there's the blood of Pharaoh bathing in the blood of children. So when Tosus mentions the Yerushalmi, in fact, this is a machlokes on the two, the Panei Moshe and the Korban Ha'eda, the two Mepharshim, classically on the Yerushalmi, argue as to what blood it is. Is it the positive blood or is it the negative blood? So once again, over here, you have within the same food, within the same item, you have the same tension. The tension of tachas ha-tapuach aratich and the notion of this, the idea of cement. So when we eat this, there's a multiple dimension again, not just of servitude, not just of freedom, but the two embedded so closely within one another. Very, very fascinating. Very fascinating idea. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch actually says that one should have it, one should have apple, and it should look like tit, and one should add wine. And the reason is because you try to incorporate all these ideas. So when you're going through this beautiful, sensual, enjoyable experience, at the same time, you're experiencing all the different tastes, all the different pieces of what went on through the experience of Mitzrayim, the complexities of that.
Wouldn't it be the also
the other
thing
that
blood
is the, when it also represents the course of the Koshin Ashibud, and the difficulty in the Shibud, that's why the only result could have so many children.
On your platz of Bnei Israel.
Those who worked,
Shevet Levi did not have that.
Didn't have that brought to that extent.
Beautiful.
So when the Jews are standing there, and they think it's bad, ultimately it's actually being flipped around to good.
Beautiful.
So
beautiful.
Double linkage.
So yes, that was the extra point. That was the extra point. Is that Shevet Levi didn't get this. Shevet Levi didn't get this. Why? Because they didn't have to suffer. So therefore, they didn't have to suffer. Therefore, they didn't have the extra numbers. So actually, if you do the cheshbon and the math, you'll see that Shevet Levi didn't grow as exponentially as the rest of Israel. Why? Because they didn't have to suffer to get the bracha of growing, which is why the two are embedded so closely and finely together. Evan?
I go back to the original sin problem, because the apple was the original sin. The apple was the reason why there was such pains in birth, and the reason why we went into total, we got kicked out of Gan Eden, and we went into slavery in the first place.
Right, so you're right. There's a whole deeper idea over here, which we need to keep aware of, is that there is the, we'll call it primeval sin, the idea of the nachash, and why it is that the apple's over here as well. There's a bigger picture over here, which is we should spend time on. I'm not spending time on it at this point in time, But what I wanted to do is capture the tension. But you're absolutely right. There's even greater depth than this. This is idea number, I think we're up to idea number four, maybe. So, Maror. Now let's keep count over here. Rabban Gamliel, right? Rabban Gamliel says this is the point where everybody says, okay, kids from the couch, whoever's hanging out in the kitchen from the kitchen, let's read it, let's translate it, let's do everything we need to. This is the most important part of the Seder. Rabban Gamliel says there was three things you need to say, and they are Maror, Pesach, and Maror, Matzah, and Pesach, right? So you need to say all three of them. But the problem is the way he says it is, that now chronologically, folks, let's think about it. What happened first? What happened was the morrow is terrible. The matzah, now matzah can go both ways. Matzah is the bread of affliction. It's the bread of freedom. Okay, we'll put it in the middle. Pesach is certainly at the end of the day, right? Pesach is the end of the process. So why? Meaning you're conveying to us the most important things and you put them out of order. Now, you might think alphabetical, right? Let's try, you know, maybe it's alphabetical at the very least. But it's not really alphabetical, right? It doesn't work. The pay comes afterwards. So there obviously is an order, and he's not telling us what the order is. Why is it that the Maror comes later? So actually, this week, I had the fortune of hearing from Rabbi Mansur, and he suggested something very fascinating, very, very fascinating. And that is that we just read a few weeks ago in Parshas Kisisa, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain, and this is the end of that second Aliyah, where everybody by that point everybody is switched off. It's where, you know, nobody's paying attention at this point in time except for the Balei Kriya, who notices that it's the Kriya Satorah for Tanis, right? But in and amongst that, Moshe Rabbeinu asks some very profound questions, and one of the questions he says is Vayomer Harein No Es Kavodecha, God, please show me your honor, right? Show me your honor. Let me see your honor in this world. So what's he asking for? What's Moshe Rabbeinu troubled by at this point in time? The honor of God, what does that mean? So the Gemara says, the Gemara Brachos goes on to say that there was actually a deeper question over here. He was asking, he was asking the time-old question, which is called Tzadik Viralo. The fact that how is it that the righteous suffer and that the evil do well, right? How is it, show me your ways in this world. Harininos Tarchecha is the previous pasuk which was expressed the same idea. Show me the way in which you interact with the world. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense looking at history. It doesn't make sense. Some views in the Gemara about Basra go so far as to say that Eov was in fact Moshe Rabbeinu. Now the idea of Job, this conceptual man, not Moshe Rabbeinu himself, but lived in the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu. The theodicy, what is called academically, or trying to understand how Hashem interacts with the world, doesn't make a lot of sense. The Gemara in Brachos debates, in fact, whether Moshe Rabbeinu got an answer or not. The Gemara debates whether Hashem fully answered Moshe Rabbeinu or didn't fully answer Moshe Rabbeinu. And the debate really is there a way that humanity can comprehend the notion of theodicy at all? What does the Pesukim say? What does the Pesukim say the answer was? Hashem says, in the response in Pasuk Chof Gimel, what happens is I'm going to put you in the Nikra Satsur, I'm going to put you in this cleft of the rock, and I'm going to cover you, and when I let you see, all you're going to see is my passing, that I already passed by, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you're not going to see my face. What does that mean? Chasam Sofer has a response in which he talks about this, and he says the following. He says that in history, one can really only understand God retrospectively. Here's an example which is so well captivated is, you know, a person's part of a book club, and they meet on a monthly basis, and they go through their book, and they discuss it, and for a particular book, you know, John walks in, and he's sitting around the table, and everybody is going to review the book and say what they thought of it, and John, who's been a participant now for 3.5 years, he's on the gold star membership level already, and he gets up and he says, you know, I just found that this book was completely lacking a plot. There wasn't a sense of continuity. I would not recommend this book for anybody else. There just wasn't even a theme. It didn't connect. The whole thing didn't make sense. There was no ending. So, and then everybody else takes a turn, and, you know, Jane and Susan, and everybody goes around the table, and they all have such wonderful reviews, and they're going to read every other book this author has ever put out, and they're going to recommend it to everybody else. It's a 6-star book, you know, and they come around the table, and they come back to John, and they say, John, were you reading the same book? And he says, yeah, I was. And they say, can we see it? So he holds it up. It's the same book that they were just reading that reviewed for that month. And so the person who is orchestrating the book club says, can I just see your copy? And he pulls out, and it turns out that his book starts on page 54. And the last three chapters are missing. It was a misprint. So he started reading the book, and he didn't have the first 53 pages, and he doesn't have the last three chapters. So they say, John, you know what? Why don't you go home, take this copy, take a good copy, read the book, and come back, and we can discuss it. And lo and behold, he sends an email to the whole group the next day. You know, I totally agree, rave reviews, it was wonderful. The point is that, as it says the Chasam Sofer, is that sometimes we don't have access to HaKadosh Baruch Hu only when we have the full picture, because we live in the here and now. We live in 5775, and we have a perspective, and we have a certain perspective of things, and we have a little bit of a narrow gauge of history. We have our little thin slice of the pie. But lo and behold, history didn't start when we were born. Some people may think that. But in the end of the day, history did not start, the world did not start when we were born. The world started almost 6,000 years ago, and there's been a lot of history to get to this point, and in fact, we haven't got the last few chapters either. We don't have the full book. So when you look at the book and you ask to give a review, you say, well, there's no plot, it's not continuous, it's contradictory, it doesn't make sense. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's Panala Yarog. You're not going to see me in history when you look at me frontally. You're going to only understand me if you look in the bigger perspective. We don't have the bigger perspective yet. Wait, says the Pasuk. We went down to Mitzrayim. Look at the whole process. When you had to speak to those people in the process, it was terrible. I mean, you can imagine, this is genocide, this is there were children being murdered. It was terrible. The whole thing was an atrocious process. But say, Chazal, that looking back at it, there's different ways of describing it. The Midrash says it was a kura barz, it was a smelting pot. It was the way that it was a necessary function of being formed. The Aruch HaShulchan talks about how, in fact, we only were able to understand the notion of servitude to God via servitude to another nation. We're only able to get our sense of nationhood through this experience. Meaning, in the experience, you wouldn't have understood it. When it's happening, you don't understand. Another example is, you know, a child walks into the doctor's office. And I heard this idea from Rabbi Mansour, beautiful idea. Child walks into the doctor's office. And this 2-year-old who thinks the whole world is wonderful, in walks a person in a white coat. Not always in all doctors' offices anymore, but a person with a white coat walks in with this long metal needle. And the child thinks that the mother is going to fend off this aggressor to protect her child. And in fact, instead of doing that, the child is held down by her mother, betrayed, and in pain inflicted, which lasts for a few days afterwards. And the child cannot understand this. 10 years later, the child, and 10, 12 years later, the child starts reading on the internet and says, you know, why is that I didn't get measles? What happened to the chicken pox? I'd never heard about these things. I'm reading about them now. So the mom says, oh, I'm so glad you asked. Remember 13 years ago when I was holding you down and you held onto the door handles on either side and you had to pull off your shoes in order to get you back into the seat. Remember that? That was your inoculation. Why? Because it took a little bit of time to understand what was going on. So it's a ponalo yiro. You can only understand it sometimes a little bit later. So therefore, says Rabban Gamliel, how does the Seder work? In order to be able to understand the Maror, you need to have the Pesach and Matzah first. You need to be able to understand the process of redemption. You need to have a bit of perspective. Then you say, oh, Maror, okay, now makes sense. You can't always dwell in the Maror at the time that you're going through it. That's what Rabban Gamliel educationally switches the order to explain that that's the only way to access it. If you take this one step further, and maybe we'll just try to get in two more quick ideas here, is famously, everybody asks, there's the Chacham and the Rasha, and, you know, in the end of the day, they're asking the same question. Let's give the guy a break. What's going on? What was God commanding whom? You! And then the Rasha comes along and says, what's this for you? And we say, ah, you exclude yourself. Right, Kevon. Right, he says, he's not including himself. The Chacham wasn't including himself. Everybody asks this question, and there's the beautiful blue box and the art scroll, and everybody knows that answer, which is wonderful. But there's a beautiful Hasidic thought by the Rav Shitzer, who says the most unbelievable idea, and that is the following. I was bowled over, so everybody hold onto your seats. And that is the following. The Gemara says that the Chosam, the signet of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is Emes, is truth. Right? So meaning, you know, we all have, you know, in those days where you'd have a signet ring and you'd put it onto the wax and you'd put your emblem on it. So the emblem of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is emes, is truth. Says Rashi, why is that? Rashi, this is not Chassidus. Rashi says that the reason is because if you look at the word emes, you take the word emes, you take the letters that comes from the first letter of the alphabet, the last letter of the alphabet, and the center letter of the alphabet. Truth is something that you find wherever you see it, says Rashi. Truth is something which, wherever you turn to, it's substantiated because it's true. It speaks for itself. Whereas if you look at the word sheker, shin kuf resh, those letters are one after the other. Sheker, falsehood, is an expression of something where you only see a narrow gauge of what's going on. Sheker can only be substantiated within a certain circumstance. And it's interesting that what often happens is that you can create all the alibis necessary for a particular story, but just give it a little bit of time, just give it a little bit of conversation, and usually it's very hard to substantiate that because you have to protect a certain bubble. And that's all that there really is the little world that you've created in the world of Sheker, because it's very little, it's very small. Emes is much more all-pervading. So if you take it back to what we had just beforehand, says the Rabshitz, it's a very fascinating idea. And that is that when the Chacham uses the word you, he uses the word eschem, you. Now notice that is the word that includes the letter aleph and taf, the beginning and the end, and the two center ones are mem and chof, the middle section of the aleph base. Meaning, he's asking about you, but his sense of you, his sense of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did was an all-pervasive one. He's asking, how did God interact with history as a whole? Come back to the Rasha. What is his word? He says, Ma avodazos lachem, lamed chof mem. Those are all consecutive letters at one point in history, only in the middle of the story. The Rasha is, the lack of information the Rasha has is because he did exactly what Rav Gamliel told him not to do. Is he stuck at one point, one slice of the pie, that's all he's looking at. That's why it's ulefi shehoithi es atzmoi. What did he take out? The aleph and the taf. He doesn't have the first 53 pages. He doesn't have the last three chapters. And that's all he's asking. He's only stuck with one piece. That's why he says lachem. One last idea, perhaps, and then with this we'll end. If you go back to the end of the Haggadah, nobody likes to hear words on Haggadah. It's a travesty. Every year, I have a tune I want to teach people on Haggadah. Nobody's willing to listen. It's terrible. I feel like the Haggadah really gets shafted. So, but in the end of the day, there's one idea which really is worth considering, and that is the following. If you're to do a backwards and forwards in Haggadah, right? So we know that the goat, whatever it represents Israel, it's good, right? Goat is good. So therefore, if you now let's do the math. So that means to say that who's the bad guy over here? The bad guy is that cat, right? So then, okay, but don't worry, the cat is going to be taken care of. There's the good dog, right? But then, unfortunately, the terrible stick enters the scene. So if you go backwards, you go bad, good, bad, good, bad, good. You know what happens? There's something very unfortunate which happens. Which side of the puzzle is HaKadosh Baruch Hu on? Doesn't work out, right? So what's going on over here? So, you know, what are we supposed to learn from this? Says the Vilna Gaon. No, of course, you have to understand things in perspective. The reason why that cat was eating the goat, the reason why that dog was biting the cat, was not because the dog was this knight in shining armor with a arm and tail, or whatever, however you put it. The dog is not doing it because he's altruistically seeking the word of God. You know why he's doing it? Because he's a dog, and that's a cat. The reason why Paro was doing it was because he was a dictator, and a dictator does certain things. But you know what happens? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you look at history, you'll realize that the dog biting the cat, even though it's doing it because it's instinctual, is my doing. What you need to do is you need to take a bit of a bigger perspective and say, I'm going to look at the whole array of history, and everything doing what it does because of its natural inclinations, in the end of the day, it creates the bigger picture that HaKadosh Baruch Hu kills the Malachim Aves. Because that's the bigger picture. It's not good, bad, good, bad. History is much more complex than that. But the point is that within the history, you see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand. And that's how we end off the Seder, because that's how we begin the Seder. Where we start off with the Karpas, where you don't see necessarily where it's going and how it's leading to, and the end of the day is Chad Gaja, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge of everything. Thank you very much. I hope these ideas are very stimulating.